Michael Waltowski, Reel 2. So you were taken to the school.
This school, they're all old friends were gathered, mainly women and children. And in that school, my sister and the youngest brother, of course, were delighted to see us joining. And when we all sort of were sorted out, names taken down and so on and so on, eventually the whole lot, we were transported in horse carts again to the railway station.
Did you have any idea where you were going to be taken? Or
no, none at all. None at all. Didn't have a clue of what was going to happen to us. But anyway, we didn't go to the nearest railway station, but we went to a railway station a couple of miles away where the train was waiting. It was a normal train suitable for cattle, really. And there was all the crying going on and so on. They loaded us and eventually shut the doors and bolted it. And I found myself in the carriage with mainly women and children, but very pleased that I found my girlfriend, Nella. He was also there because her father was in the police force. So it was a little bit of a sort of cheering little element. Her mother was there as well. And all you could hear is perpetual crying, you see. There was women and children. And the train started roaring and passing the village of Stare Sovo. This is where I used to stay with my grandfather and uncle and so on. And eventually I remember that with my fist I managed to break a piece of metal which was on top of the carriage, which was an opening for wintertime stove, really. So I managed to break it, and I managed to show my head in it, and I saw my half-brother standing there, wailing and obviously crying. And off we went by train to, and we stopped at the city of Lvov. And when we were at the huge railway station there, they were preparing us for this long journey to Kazakhstan in the Soviet Union. I don't know why, but I always felt sort of in all my young days to be a leader. I never liked to subordinate myself because I suffered for it quite a lot as well. But I took sort of almost charge of this contingent of women and children. And then at one point, a soldier, a Red Army soldier, opened the door and said, "You're allowed to get some water." So I took a bucket and went. He led me to the basement of the building, and there was a tap. I filled it up. But he actually walked out, and there was a window open. And really what I sensed later, that he hoped that I would escape, really. But I had no intention whatsoever to escape. I came back, and they again shut, and we started off the journey, which lasted, I can't remember exactly, but it was probably 5-6 days. But only once they opened, it was extremely cruel because of sanitation and the mere fact that the carriage was absolutely filled up to capacity. We were all lying on the floor, and people were in a dreadful state. When we crossed the Polish border, I don't know how some of the ladies sensed when we crossed, there was a terrible screaming cry and a song famous Polish religious song they sang, and we entered, which was the Soviet Ukraine, and we went to Kiev, then to Kharkov, and to Orenburg, and from Orenburg, Aktubinsk, we went south to a small town called Jurun, which was Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. And then they opened the gates again, not the gates, but the doors, and we saw there's Kyrgyzians, Asiatic tribesmen. They waited in various horse carts, and they looked at us with sort of amazement and suspicion, and we equally looked at them with amazement and suspicion. And they took us from this station of Jurun, it was about 25 kilometers, to a collective farm. And they placed us in hovels, which really and truly were more suitable for cattle than human beings. There was no floor as such, but earthen floor. And I remember we had nothing to eat and so on, and I went to the manager of the collective farm. I said, we have no food and so on. Well, his reply was, in Russian, of course, the first sentence of the Soviet Union Constitution, who doesn't work, doesn't eat, you see. So he said, you must start working. And so eventually we started working all these menial jobs on the collective farm. My first engagement was sitting at the back of the tractor, the vastness of the field was absolutely unbelievable, and my job was to regulate huge plow, and we even did this work during the night with for my work, I used to receive a chunk of bread and some semi-skimmed milk, and also I had soup. But the bread I would take to my family, and I always remember how my youngest brother said, he's not going to eat it, because he said, you work, you must eat, and of course it was very painful for me. But I shared all that I earned between the four of us.
They weren't given jobs, or?
Eventually, my sister was given a job too, and my younger brother, he was looking after the sheep. And I always remember when my youngest brother, which was one of those scenes you experience and still remember, when he was sitting, the poor lad, on the horseback, and shouted with the greatest of joy. He said, Miesek, Miesek, that was my diminutive name in Polish. He said, I'm going to get food now, I'm working. You see, he was working, you see. So all it went on, various jobs, which is unbelievable, this life in Kyrgyzstan. Well, it was Kyrgyzstan before the revolution, but it was Kazakhstan, the Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. And the severest part of it was the winter, because it was minus 50 centigrade. And we were all covered in snow. I had to dig ourselves out. And the jobs we used to have, it was like looking after a sheep farm. Our girls, some of them lovely, good-looking young ladies, you know. And I always remember this hunger, which was so prevalent. when one of those charming young ladies, she said once to me how she would love if I would make love to her. I said, my dear, you give me bread instead. I don't want any love. And so, but that's what I remember the Russians used to say, that they'll reduce you to such a state that you'll never want sex anymore in your lifetime. But
how were you treated on the farm? How did the supervisors treat you?
Well, on the farm, you see, those Kyrgyzians were basically quite friendly. They really and truly were a little bit, one detected later on, they were rebellious against being forcefully enrolled into the collective farm system, because they were nomads. And as I attended on one occasion, I was invited to a tent where they used to perform their traditional sort of feast, which was a huge urn and a lamb being boiled there. And they're all sitting on the floor, obviously. And I remember I was given a chunk of that lamb with a bit of pastry floating on top of it, which was to me an absolute treat, as a matter of fact. But they used to explain to me that they used to move around the steppes of Kazakhstan in the old days with their cattle and men and women from place to place, and that's the life they loved. They couldn't really quite get used to the collective farm system being, but they used to work there, and gradually, you see, the hunger was always prevalent. And I remember on one occasion at night, I went by train to this nearest town of Jurun, and I walked from house to house, and I asked for bread. And as a matter of fact, nobody refused, but they would give me a slice of bread or two slices of bread. And I loaded a sack full of this bread and I went back to the station and I jumped on the nearest train that went towards this village of ours, collective farm village. And when I got off, of course, the NKVD, the security police, arrested me. And they arrested me and very severely interrogated me. And I remember I cried. They accused me that I was collecting this bread because I was planning to escape back to Poland. And eventually they took pity on me and let me go with a sack of dried bread.
They let you keep the bread?
Yes, they let me keep the bread. So for my family, it was a tremendous joy that they saw a bit of bread and saw me back as well. So it went on for some time, this peculiar work. I used to be engaged on, I remember, you see, there was no fuel as such, but we used to go around those steps and collect cattle dung. And this dung, I always remember what a joy it was to find a big lump of it dried up. And that used to be collected, and we used to use it as a fuel simply for cooking and so on. But as far as the farm was concerned, it was collected on a larger scale, and then it was mixed with shrub, because there were no trees growing there at all. And in cubes, I remember cutting it into cubes and so on, then drying it up. And that was the fuel which was for the entire village supplied for all sorts of purposes in the winter and so on.
So the accommodation you were living in was...
Well, it was really and truly like a hovel. It was one room. We slept on, there were no beds, we slept on the floor. And my sister Anna was cooking. I don't know what she was cooking, but somehow we managed to live. We used to get from the collective farm in remuneration for our labors. We were classified as really cheap labor, therefore the allocation of food was only half to what other workers on the farm were getting. But somehow life went on. And the turning point was brewing gradually when one day NKVD lot came. They were all smartly dressed in civilian clothes. And they wanted to interview young people, mainly young men. There was a group of us, students mainly. And we were all interviewed. And they more or less implied during the interview that their intention was to to restore us to a normal life and offer us further education and see how we would fit in into it. But all they wanted was the particulars of all of us, which they did collect. Mm-hmm. And then they applied a very simple trick on us, which later on it all came out quite clear, that one day one of our friends of our group,
just check we're still running here. Yes, we are, right.
But one of our friends disappeared, and his mother was extremely disturbed and so on. He was actually my girlfriend's, Nella's, brother. He disappeared. And the NKVD came and they collected us in the village hall and accused us of planning an escape for him. And they warned us that really and truly would be very severely punished if we do any planning and so on. But at the same time, what coincided with this visit of security men was that on one occasion, one of our very young boys who was employed on regulating the deaths of the plow, he unfortunately fell asleep and was rolled up and died. And during his funeral, my friend Zygmunt Holinsky, he made a speech, and he used the phrase that this boy worked very hard for a slice of Soviet Union bread and paid a very high price. Well, that was also reported by the Komsomol boys who attended actually the funeral as well. They were always spying on us all the time, how we behaved and so on. And that was also taken into account by the security men and KVD boys. But anyway, they came, they warned us, and they said that we instigated the escape of this boy to Poland. But you see, what happened, as we all later on discovered. But anyway, I'll go back the sequence of it all. So they departed. And then a couple of weeks later, when we worked on hay gathering, suddenly a lorry appeared from a distance heading towards us. And they stopped. And Red Army boys came out shouting, "Come along, drop the tools onto the lorry." And they put us, that's two Holinskis, Nella and myself, onto the lorry. They put us in the corners. "You're not allowed to look at each other. You mustn't talk. You're not allowed to talk." And they took us to Aktibinsk prison. Long journey. And they placed us all in separate cells. And I remember landing in a cell which, in comparison, when you see what our British boys are getting in prison, it was absolutely hell in comparison, because it was just bare floor and my tunic was my pillow, and that was all. It's completely empty. And interrogation started. It used to start always at midnight. Always at midnight, I was called to the room. And in this actual detention, well, it was a prison, really. It was a station prison. It was very quiet, dead silence always. And from time to time, the spy little opening would open, and he would look inside what's going on, and he would gently open the door. They used to practice it regularly all the time, and he would whisper, "What is your name?" And he would tell them, and he said, "No," he shut the door. You see, this, the whole time they were trying psychologically to break you down.
So when he opened the door, he asked you your name.
Your name again, and then so on. Oh, no, it's not the boy we wanted. They used to do silly things during the interrogation, because there were all sorts of tricks. I had to sit in a high sort of chair with my knees right towards my chin. And I fainted a few times, but I would... In the morning, they would lead me back to the cell, and you were not allowed to sleep during the day.
Mm. And what were they wanting to find out?
Now this is what the accusations. He said you were planning to escape to Poland, but because I wrote letters to my half-brother in Poland, simply describing where we were and maybe mentioning what we were doing, and, of course, I was very patriotic at that time, like we all were. And, you see, they accused, because I was writing simply letters. There was no paper to write on even. But they accused us. The accusations were that I shall refer to myself, not to the group, because later on we'll come to the group. But I was accused of being a co-editor of an underground Polish counter-revolutionary paper called Exiles. And that we also were criticizing the Soviet Union, criticizing the collective farm system, and that I was a son of the Polish policeman, which was a crime as well. Mm. And that I believed in God. That was almost a crime, too. And this went on. And each time I was interrogated for about 3 weeks. And they used to do all sorts of tricks, like I was sitting in this chair and he would put a revolver on his desk. But what was fascinating, that I was interrogated all the time by a security chap who visited us in the collective farm, and as I later discovered, he was Captain Cheremiskin. And he appeared for the first time when I was called for the interview in his uniform as captain of NKVD. You see, he appeared before as a civilian all the time. And so
Sorry. You say the style of the interrogation, was it aggressive all the time?
No, they used to very quietly ask the question, "Now tell me, did you edit or co-edit this underground? Why did you do it? You knew it was a crime to criticize the system, because you were really a counter-revolutionary, which was a crime, according to the Soviet legislation." But he was quite gentle. When I fainted, he picked me up. But he used to do tricks like dead silence. And suddenly, as I was sitting there, about a group of 15 security men would roll in the middle of the night and shouting, "Tell the truth," and turning to Cheremiskin, saying to him, "He should be shot, he should be shot," and shouting your noise, and then they would depart and leave me again, you see. Then they would say, "Tell the truth," and they took me to the room with a buffet filled with beautiful food and said, "Tell us the truth and you'll be able to help yourself to it." And I was too weak to faint. I never really confessed at all, because there was nothing to confess to. Yeah.
How did you cope with this? I mean, it must have been, how did you manage, you know, to...
Well, you see, I was going to the cell and crying, and I used to recollect for consolation all sorts of prayers. What was interesting, that on one hand, this molestation didn't alter my patriotism. On the contrary, it probably helped to retain it. And at the same time, perhaps this is typical of human beings. When in fear, they turn to God. So I was trying to keep my brain active by trying to recap in Latin, whether it was parts of the Mass in Latin. And it's amazing how you would actually recollect it. And eventually it came back to me, you know, Pater Noster, Quies in Cherem, and so on and so on. But one day, when I was led, for instance, after the interrogation, and when they shouted he should be shot, you see the two Red Army boys, or security boys, well, they just put me against the wall and with the rifles aimed at me, and then took me back to the cell. You see, this is the sort of thing they used to practice to break you down. And in the end, they succeeded, really, because I was just finished, more or less, after 3 weeks of this sort of interrogation.
It's a long time.
And food was, you see, in the cell, I was given about a liter of boiled water in the morning and a chunk of bread. And in the evening, I was given only boiled water, you see. Well, after 3 weeks, you soon go down. And we used to get a piece of onion later on. But all this business was basically to break you down psychologically, like calling you from the cell, taking you around the corner, and then they suddenly clipped my hair and back into the cell. Always dead silence and interrogation. Captain Cheremiskin would leave his pistol on the desk and walk out and leave me alone. And it just sounds stupid in a way. I mean, didn't expect me to get hold of the revolver. But this business of seeing food and so on, and that was very depressing. And on one occasion, they pushed a German man into my cell. I was on my own all the time. They pushed a German man. And that German man was interrogated, but he used to come back crying, and he was teaching me, as a matter of fact, to pray in German, and he did teach me, you know, Vater uns, im Himmel. And he cried because they used to beat him, and eventually he died, you see. But he was telling me the stories, that he was a great believer communism, and after the First World War, he decided to settle down in the Soviet Union. And he used to tell me that all he achieved was really a tiny little hovel and a goat and a little garden, and that's all. But because, remember, it was a period when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, that he used to receive from his relations some parcels sometimes, but he was there accused of spying.
Stop here. Michael Waltowski, end of reel 2.